This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Michael Ratner will report on a few of the positive developments in some of the post-9/11 issues we've covered.
We had some nice news hearing that Steve Cambone resigned, aide to Rumsfeld, another one of our defendants in our lawsuit in Germany. Soon we may get rid of them all.
We'll bring you a Law and Disorder exclusive, a talk by Fast Food Nation author Eric Schlosser on prison stats in this country, something that he's been collecting over the past several years in preparation for a new book.
Here at Law and Disorder, we focus a lot on Bagram, Abu Ghraib, and Guantanamo. But we don't want you to forget the prison system in this country that is imprisoning millions and millions of people in harsh conditions.
We'll bring you an in-depth and disturbing update from Liz McIntyre, author of the book Spy Chips, on RFID chips that are being increasingly used in consumer products and even in human bodies.
We'll even tell you about a bizarre chip that can give you an electroshock from a distance. You're walking through a store, zap!
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Michael, it seems that over the past couple of weeks, there have been many stories in the news, many of which are more positive than what we're usually used to reading on some of the post-9/11 developments that we've covered here. The center has been involved in a lot of Guantanamo cases. Is there a significant update that we should know about?
Well, there's always an update with Guantanamo, although we're getting a little bit better opinions. You know, we're coming into this next year. January 11th is the fifth anniversary of people being kept in cages at Guantanamo. So it's not exactly the happiest period I've seen for people. We've won two Supreme Court cases, and yet they continue to insist on their right to hold people without trial and now, of course, without the right of habeas corpus.
And just, I'm curious, of those people, how many approximately have been there for the full 5 years?
Well, there's 460 people there now. I think almost all of those people have been there the full 5 years. The one positive development was a district court judge, Gladys Kessler, issued a very sharp opinion against the government in a recent case. A client of ours named Hamid El-Razik has filed a petition in court, and we've been trying to get him representation. The government came in and said he doesn't get to be represented by the center or other people or by a co-detainee down in Guantanamo. Why doesn't he file the petition himself? And the government said this thing ought to be just dismissed. This guy's been there for 5 years. Well, Judge Kessler wrote a great opinion in which she basically pointed out that this guy may not be capable of filing a petition by himself. And she goes through the facts. He's had virtually no contact with the news media or any word from outside for over 3 years. No contact with friends or family, unfamiliar with the U.S. court system, does not speak English, does not know what the term habeas corpus means, has no criminal charges against him, has every reason to distrust his captors and keepers, has every reason to rely on the friendship with other detainees who speak his language and suffer the same disabilities, saying in that a co-detainee ought to be able to help him get into court. He has every reason to challenge his confinement, she goes on to say. She goes on with more of those circumstances. He doesn't have access to a law library. He can't communicate with his attorney. No expectation of release ever. This is the judge, a federal judge, writing this. In light of these facts, what judge goes on to say, there can be little doubt in the court's mind that Mr. El-Razzik is not able to challenge the legality of his detention on his own. And then, in the key line in the opinion, the longer those appellate proceedings drag on, those are like other proceedings that we at the center have to try and get rights for people, the more problematic it becomes as to whether continuing to dismiss these cases, the judge says, or continuing to not let them go forward serves the interest of justice. She says, and she quotes, it is often said that, quote, justice delayed is justice denied. And then she says, nothing could be closer to the truth with reference to the Guantanamo Bay cases. So there you have a federal judge saying justice delayed is justice denied. And that's what we're facing in Guantanamo. And while it's late in the game, at least they're starting to get the picture.
Michael, do you think that this important decision by Judge Kessler will spur other judges at her level to think the same kind of way, reach the same decisions in related cases?
You know, that's our hope here, Heidi. I mean, what we have here is I have this group at the center and other 500 attorneys doing everything they can to break this thing open. And we've been just stymied and stalled and stymied and stalled by the government, by the judges, by the Congress. And it's got to break open. We're coming on to this January 11th anniversary. We're planning a number of activities. Catholic Workers are, Witness Against Torture, Amnesty International, the Center for Constitutional Rights. You can actually go to the center's website and there'll be activities particularly focused around Washington and the 5th anniversary. It is the anniversary in which basically the center, and I in particular, got our first client. That's David Hicks from Australia. David is still in Guantanamo. They said they want to bring him before a military commission. They have been mucking around with that, changing the rules on him. Still there. I remember making that first call to David's lawyer in Australia in early January and filing the first habeas case on behalf of David for the Center for Constitutional Rights and David, not knowing him, but getting to represent his family. And here we are 5 years later, and David Hicks has never had a hearing in federal court. I mean, I don't know what words you use, whether you use the word gulag or Pinochet or Argentina or, you know, Devil's Island. I mean, those are all the appropriate words to describe the situation.
Well, on another front, the New York Times story on Jose Padilla's conditions resulted in several letters of outrage being written last week in the Times. I think that helps, too, to raise awareness of what we're doing all around the world, some unknown, some known.
People can't get over. I mean, the Padilla case, the pictures in the New York Times, Padilla, as people may recall, is the so-called American enemy combatant. He was the man taken off the plane in Chicago, held as an enemy combatant. And when his case finally reached the Supreme Court, they indicted him to avoid the Supreme Court. The pictures of him being goggled and earplugs and his legs being shackled are just remarkable. I mean, regular people come up to me on the street and say, what are we doing here? And this is a guy who has never been convicted of anything and during that period was never even accused of anything. And now he's accused of some crime in Florida as a last resort. But essentially, they treated this person not even as good as you would treat an animal in a cage. I mean, you have to say that. This guy was treated incredibly cruelly. And you can just imagine what we've been doing to people all over the world.
Well, they say that when the public knows what's really going on, they usually rise to the occasion with appropriate outrage. And I think we've just haven't let people know what's going on in the mainstream media until now.
I think those pictures of Padilla really did affect people.
We're coming to the end of the year, and another development is that we've seen some significant resignations around the country. What's happening on that front?
Well, this all relates in a way to the case that and I'd like to think it relates to the case that we filed in Germany. We filed, as listeners know, a case the Center for Constitutional Rights did against Rumsfeld and other people we believe were involved in the torture program. Rumsfeld resigned just before we filed the case, and now his key deputy, Stephen Cambone, who was also named as a defendant in the German case, has also resigned. Now, names like Stephen Cambone are not widely known to the American public, even to probably progressive radio listeners. Stephen Cambone, though, was a key aide to Rumsfeld. You would have to say he was sort of the, in some way, he and a man named Boykin, but who is also a defendant, were the torture implementers. They're the ones who really took the orders down from Rumsfeld or others and made sure that detainees, whether in Guantanamo or in Abu Ghraib, were tortured. And he in particular, Steve Cambone, is the one that apparently ordered General Miller. General Miller was in charge of Guantanamo in August, in the summer really of 2003, and they'd already implemented all this stuff in Guantanamo, from, you know, the dogs to the stripping to the hooding. And he's the one that told General Miller and sent General Miller to Iraq to, quote, Gitmoize Iraq. That's August 2003. And, of course, shortly after Gitmoizing Iraq, in fact, 2 months afterwards, are when the photos of Abu Ghraib were taken, not show up. That's when it happened. So here you have Stephen Cambone, who I believe, in my opinion, is one of the is really at the center of the torture program, having resigned. And happily, we have him as a defendant in our lawsuit.
And we have another positive development in the case of Brandon Mayfield from the West Coast. Listeners will remember that he was targeted unjustly by the government, unfairly, and he's recently won a multi-million-dollar settlement. What else do we need to know, Michael?
Well, we've been trying to keep our listeners up to date about the Brandon Mayfield case. I was very, very excited. You know, on the other hand, it's the one of the first, if not the only time, that the U.S. government has actually apologized for a wrong arrest and actually paid damages. You all remember Brandon Mayfield was, they supposedly said that he had his fingerprint on a backpack that was found in the train station at the bombing in 2004 in Spain. Despite the Spanish saying that's not his fingerprint, they went ahead and they took Brandon Mayfield in as a, quote, material witness without any charges, kept him there for 19 days. They raided his house. They did all kinds of other things. The guy was a lawyer in Portland, and, you know, completely fallacious case. Remarkable that they actually apologized and settled. Now, what's interesting about his case is the part that didn't settle, which Brandon refused to settle, and they probably said, we want you to drop the whole case. But he said, I'm not dropping my challenge to the Patriot Act, and the, particularly the part of the Patriot Act that allowed them to go into my house on a warrant without me knowing about it, a sneak and peek warrant, and or listen to his phone calls. It was an expansion of the Patriot Act, so you no longer really needed criminal conduct to be able to wiretap somebody. So he's still continuing that challenge. So that is a positive development. I mean, pieces are coming apart in this administration, but we still have a long way to go. But Brandon Mayfield is a significant victory, and my only hope is that I wish that it puts a slap on the wrist of FBI and other agents who are essentially going around the country targeting Muslims who should not be targeted.
And it was certainly high profile enough that a lot of people are aware of it.
Yeah, El-Masri, as people remember, is one of the people that we know was rendered to Afghanistan or another country for torture. He's the German citizen. He was picked up in Macedonia on a vacation he was taking from Germany, put on a bus, and eventually somehow flown or however he got to Afghanistan, where he was kept for 5 months and had the heck tortured out of him. He then was released after they realized it was a mistake, although the U.S. government has never admitted it was a mistake, and he's back in Germany, and the ACLU has brought a case in the United States on his behalf against various U.S. officials for his rendition. The U.S., unlike the Brandon Mayfield case, has never admitted it was a mistake, has never apologized to him, but in a sense, they've almost said it was a mistake because he was recently allowed into the United States on a visa, unlike the Center for Constitutional Rights clients, Maha Arar, the man rendered to Syria, who has not been given a visa to the United States. They've at least acknowledged that the guy, that at least in their view, El-Masri is no longer on their list. Now, of course, Maha Arar shouldn't be on their list either. In any case, the ACLU brought a case on his behalf. It was argued in the district court a while ago. It was dismissed in the district court on state secrets privilege, which is to say that They told El-Masri, there's nothing you can do in this case because any information we give out is a state secret, and therefore this case can't proceed. El-Masri was just here, really, for the appellate argument that just went on. I hope it went well. I mean, we'll have to see what comes out. But he was allowed into the country for it. So, again, there are these challenges both in the Center's Maha Arar case as well in Khaled El-Masri's case moving forward.
I think this is a relatively happy note on which to end the year and hope that it gets even better in 2007. We certainly worked long and hard, the Center, Amnesty, the Guild. We deserve more of these, the victories to the many injustices this administration has perpetrated on everyone.
Well, there is progress going on, but, you know, as we talk about on this program, really the deepest hole we're really in right now is Iraq. And I don't despite what we thought was an election that was supposed to help sweep us out of Iraq. The Democrats seem to be folding pretty quickly on this. Gates was reported out of the Senate confirmation hearing, and by the time people are hearing this show, will probably be confirmed without any dissent. This is a guy who, he shouldn't be running a small business, much less the Pentagon.
We've covered in depth on Law and Disorder the U.S.-run prison industry abroad, from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, Bagram Prison in Afghanistan, and Abu Ghraib in Iraq. These are the exports of one of the most highly profitable businesses in the United States. The prison industrial complex in this country has reached record-breaking occupancy. Nearly 2 million Americans are behind bars, the majority of them nonviolent offenders. They're usually poor. Many have substance abuse problems, and many are mentally ill. This, according to exhaustive research by Fast Food Nation author Eric Schlosser, who spoke at Blue Stockings Bookstore in New York about his compendium on the American prison system. Law and Disorder caught up with Eric during this talk, and we listened to an excerpt of his one-hour speech. In his talk, he warns our society of the perils of a profit-driven penal system and backs his research with well-documented facts and staggering statistics. Let's have a listen.
Even if you've never been to prison, even if you don't know anyone in prison, you are connected to this and to this system. Now, 2.1 million people behind bars is so abnormal and extraordinary, it's hard to describe. No society in human history has ever locked up this many people in prison before. Nobody's ever done it. And one of the reasons why no one's ever done it is no society's ever been rich enough to do it. It's incredibly expensive to lock away 2.1 million people. It costs $18,000 to $75,000 a year per inmate, depending on the facility. Now, to put this into perspective, right now, the state of California, in addition to Arnold Schwarzenegger, has more prison inmates than France, Great Britain, Germany, Japan, Singapore, and the Netherlands combined. That one state. And if you add up California and Texas, the number of prisoners in those two states is larger than the inmates locked up in the entire EU. And the EU has about 370 million people, and California plus Texas is maybe 45 million people. So we really, really like our prisons. But what's important to keep in mind is this is a very recent phenomenon. And, you know, as McDonald's was spreading across the United States in the last 20 years, a different system of control, a much meaner one, was spreading as well, which is our prisons. So if you go back to the early 1970s, prisons were considered obsolete. We were closing prisons. The federal government was closing prisons. Ronald Reagan, as governor of California, was closing prisons because people thought they were barbaric, because they were useless, and they served no purpose other than to create social dysfunction. But then the prison boom began in the early 1970s. There were about 300,000, 250,000 inmates in the early 1970s, and now there's 2.1 million. So this is something that's happened in the last 20 years, and it's a very, very recent phenomenon. We spend about $40 billion a year locking people away in this country. That's an enormous sum. I mean, it's not as much as we're going to spend this year to conquer another country, but the conquest of a certain group of people within this country is costing $40 billion. That's an amazing, amazing sum. So we're locking up 2.1 million people, and we're spending a fortune to do it. And what do we get for this money? I mean, what is the consumer getting for this expenditure? Well, most of us would agree that there are certain people who you do want to keep away from society. And you get politically different groups, they'll argue about who they are, but most people would agree that murderers, rapists, child molesters, and armed robbers, violent people convicted of violent crimes, are the most likely people who you'd want to lock away. So right now we've locked up about 125,000 murderers, maybe 100,000 sex offenders, and maybe 150,000 armed robbers. Now, a lot of those armed robbers, maybe they didn't want to hurt anybody, they just needed to buy drugs, but they used a weapon, they scared the shit out of people, so they're armed robbers. Now, if you add that up, that's 375,000 really, you know, people who most people would consider bad guys. And let's say a lot of, you know, some people who are in for nonviolent offenses have also committed violent crimes, so we'll give over maybe another 100,000. So now you're up to about 500,000 people who've committed acts of violence. Well, that leaves 1.6 million inmates. That's unbelievable. And the question is, well, why are those people locked up? If they didn't kill anybody, and they didn't rob anybody, and they didn't rape anybody, and they're not child molesters, you really have to look at the war on drugs for that answer. So let me just get back to, well, what are you getting for that money? Are you safer right now because we've got 2.1 million people behind bars? Well, there's no question that those people who are locked up aren't going to commit any crimes against any of you. They may be committing terrible crimes against other people who are behind bars, people who are nonviolent offenders, people who are being brutalized beyond belief, but they're not committing crimes against the rest of us. The real argument for locking people up has been crime control. But when you look at New York State, it's a very interesting case study. New York State, under Governor Rockefeller, began the prison boom. In 1973, the Rockefeller drug laws really played an instrumental role in starting this incarceration boom. And Rockefeller wanted to be president. He wanted to seem tough on crime. He did get to be vice president, but he died before he could ever run for president. So what's interesting is New York State started to build its prisons in the early 70s and really, really built a lot of prisons in the 80s. And the biggest increase in our crime occurred, especially violent crime, occurred in the 80s. So building more prisons, crime goes up. Now, other states started to really build their prisons in the late 80s, early 90s. That's when we were no longer building prisons in this state, and that's when our violent crime rate went down. So not building prisons, crime goes down. And it's very interesting to see that the big drop in violent crime that we've had in New York City corresponds very neatly with the same years in the 1990s that violent crime was going down in Canada, and they didn't build any prisons. So the argument that we are safer or that crime has gone down behind these prisons is very, very, very difficult to prove. So if we're not locking away killers and child molesters and rapists, you know, if that's not who the 2.1 million is, well, who are we locking away? Basically, we're locking away poor people. And you could argue that the $40 billion we're spending a year is one of the few social programs for the poor that still exists in this country. And that essentially these prisons are a form of low-income housing. The average income of an inmate, the average income the year before they were locked away, is $10,000. $10,000 a year. In addition to the poor, we're locking up the illiterate. And some estimates show that about 60 to 70% of all inmates are functionally illiterate. Who else are we locking up? We're locking up anyone who has a substance abuse problem and isn't wealthy enough to go into private treatment. So that if you look at who the inmates are, 70 to 80% have a history of substance abuse. We're also locking up the mentally ill. There are more mentally ill, seriously mentally ill people in prison today than all inmates for all crimes 30 years ago. And the LA County Jail is the biggest mental facility in the United States in terms of the number of of mental patients, because we deinstitutionalized mental patients in the 1980s and 90s, but we didn't really build any halfway houses or treatment centers for them. So 300,000 seriously mentally ill people, paranoid schizophrenics, you name it, are locked away. And you can't believe how they're treated in these prisons. They're improperly medicated. They're literally wandering around insane. So we've got a system that's locking away the poor, the illiterate, the substance abusing, and the mentally ill. Let's add women to the list, because the number of women in prison has increased roughly tenfold in the last 20 years. Nobody in history has ever imprisoned as many women as the United States is right now. And the women who are in prison are overwhelmingly in there for nonviolent crimes, many in there for drug crimes, and they tend to be in there because their boyfriends were drug dealers and they didn't have enough information to trade. So we have about 100,000 women. Who else do we have? Well, we've got people of color. About 3/4 of our inmates are African American or Latino. It's extraordinary. And when you look at some of the statistics, this is a return of the Jim Crow laws that supposedly were ended in the 1960s. Right now, in the United States, 1 out of every 4 young black men is in prison, in jail, on parole, or on probation. 1 out of every 4 young black men is somehow under the control of the state. And in Washington, D.C., it's 1 out of every 2 young black men under the control of the state. This is a disaster. This is an unbelievable disaster. And I genuinely believe that if Martin Luther King were alive today, this would be one of his principal issues. How does this happen? Well, most of the people of color are in there on drug charges. But when you look at who's using drugs in the United States, surprise, surprise, white people use more drugs than people of color. And when you look at young white men and young black men, they use illegal drugs at about the same rate. But young African American men are 5 times more likely to be busted, and they're more likely to be poor, so their parents can't put them into private drug treatment, and they don't have good attorneys, and that's why 3/4 of the people in prison right now are African American or Latino. Okay, so here's the plan. We're going to lock up the poor, the illiterate, the mentally ill, the dysfunctional, and the drug addicted. Big emphasis on the drug addicted, as I said, 75% to 80% of substance abuse problems. So while we've got them there, are we going to teach them to read? No. All those programs are being cut back, and Books Through Bars is like a remnant of an old idea of rehabilitation. So we're not going to teach them how to read. Well, maybe we'll get them off drugs. Well, one of the amazing things is in the last 20 years, the number of drug treatment slots in prison has actually fallen as the number of drug-addicted inmates has soared. As a matter of fact, in the last 10 years, the number of slots for drug treatment has been cut in half. So about 1 out of every 10 drug-addicted inmates has access to drug treatment. So what we do is we take predominantly nonviolent, poor people, and we lock them away, and we subject them to incredible brutality. 1 out of every 4 male inmates is sexually assaulted every year. 1 out of every 4. We basically don't give any skills, and we brutalize our inmates, and then we release them and expect them to behave. Because this whole idea of that we've gotten tough on crime by building these prisons and we've locked people up and thrown away the key is a lie. And the reality is that the typical inmate is behind bars for 2.5 years. 2.5 years. And what they get behind bars is a very, very clear lesson. that the strong will always prevail over the weak, because that's the operative culture in prison. So $40 billion a year does not buy you this impenetrable steel and concrete wall to protect you from scary people. What it buys you is an incredibly elaborate revolving door. Dysfunctional people, poor people go in, they get abused, and then they come out, and we pay for it at every turn of the revolving door. One third of the people that we release are arrested again within the first 6 months. And two thirds are arrested again within the first 3 years of release. So this is a system that is essentially thriving on failure. And its growth is being determined by failure. If you look at who's being sent to prison right now, three quarters of the people being sent to prison are going there as parole violators. So this is, there was a good book written on prisons called The Perpetual Prison Machine, Prisoner Machine. Now, how did this happen? Well, in an article I wrote some years ago for the Atlantic Monthly, I wrote about a prison industrial complex. And it would be nice to think that there was just a conspiracy of half a dozen men in a room who had devised this system, and that we could just find those men and subpoena them and get rid of them. But that's not the case. It's much more complex than that. And I mentioned earlier that this system is all about denial. Well, connected to that denial is incredible fear. And politicians have used fear, the fear in middle America of people who are different, of people who are poor, of people who have a different skin color, to create this system. And again, it started with Nelson Rockefeller, and you can talk about some of the right-wing conservatives who've been instrumental in building the prison industrial complex. But what's really sad is that liberals, liberal Democrats, were essential to this system. Mario Cuomo, one of the most liberal governors that this state has ever had, built more prison cells while he was governor than all of the governors in the history of New York State going back to the Revolution combined. And he did it to be reelected. Jerry Brown, very liberal governor in California, instrumental in the prison building boom there. So the prison industrial complex is this system. It's a political bureaucratic system that creates this self-perpetuating incarceration. And once these bureaucracies are in place, they want more inmates. And I'm writing about the private prison industry. Their economics are very similar to that of the hotel industry. You know, the bigger the occupancy rate, the more profitable. So just like a hotel, these private prisons, they don't want their guests to leave. They really don't. You can't check out.
That was Eric Schlosser, author of the bestseller Fast Food Nation, discussing his research on the American prison system for a compendium for the Atlantic Monthly. We will be playing more from this talk in the weeks to come.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Yeah.
Here on Law & Disorder, we've discussed at length issues of surveillance, from broad-ranging FBI wiretaps to lawsuits challenging the NSA to an even smaller yet all-pervasive Orwellian microchip. Today we are delighted to welcome back, and this time in the studio, Liz McIntyre, co-author of the book Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID. RFID stands for Radio Frequency Identification Chip. Tiny microchips embedded in clothing such as blue jeans, tennis shoes, and other products that broadcast or communicate by radio frequency, sending information to the database for processing. The tags can be so tiny that you may never know they are there. Retailers claim RFIDs are essential in alerting them when inventory, like sodas or clothing, are low. But author Liz McIntyre says this technology does a lot more. It accumulates information that can track and build profiles of individuals, private data that can be used for any number of purposes. Welcome, Liz, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, how are you?
Good. We're thrilled to have you back. Liz, we've talked before on a couple of segments that we've done with you about the RFID chip. But for our listeners, can you once again explain briefly what it is?
Sure. RFID stands for Radio Frequency Identification, and it's a technology that uses very tiny computer chips. Heidi, some of these are smaller than a grain of sand, and they're used to track items from a distance. Now, they're hooked up to little miniature antennas, and each of these chips and antenna combinations called RFID tags have unique identification numbers, like social security numbers for things. And there is your privacy problem. You can uniquely identify things. In fact, major corporations, we're talking Procter & Gamble, Walmart, Gillette, they want to put one of these RFID tags on every single product on planet Earth. I mean, every shirt, every shoe, every pair of pants, everything.
So right now, they're being used for consumer items.
We're starting to see those in places like Walmart, on larger items like Hewlett-Packard printer scanners, Lexmark printer scanners. We've seen some on some Sanyo TV set boxes, and right now they're on the outside of the boxes, but plans show they're looking to put those in more stealthy places, deep within products, where people can't see them and possibly can't remove them.
The rationale for this is for inventory, supposedly.
Yeah, well, right. Well, obviously, it's great to be able to see inside boxes without opening them up, because these communicate by radio waves, like, you know, the radio waves people are listening to this program on today. You know, those radio waves travel out in space, right through solid objects. Well, these RFID radio waves also travel through solid objects like our purses, our backpacks, our wallets, and boxes. And so, you know, it's helpful in the warehouse. If you have a box full of items that are tagged, you can simply point one of what we call a reader device. It sends out a pulse of electromagnetic radiation. It activates these tags, which by themselves just sit there. They don't really beam anything out till they're activated. Then those tags can beam back those unique identification numbers. And of course, that can link to unlimited information in a database.
How pervasive are the readers?
Well, of course, that's another thing that's a mystery, because these things can also be so easily hidden in doorways, under ceiling tiles, under floor tiles, and park benches.
So I can walk down the street and I may not know it, but there could be 10 or 20 different readers?
Absolutely. They can be easily hidden. And we have actually uncovered plans for just that.
How far away? And can you talk about the plans you've uncovered?
Sure. Well, we were talking a little earlier about IBM's identification and tracking of persons using RFID tagged items. Well, part of that patent application, they've developed a person tracking unit. And they suggest that the government...
IBM has developed this.
And IBM suggests that the government could track people through these tags we're talking about that are in their clothing, their shoes, and other possessions in public places. And in this patent application, they name the places: airports, train stations, bus stations, libraries, elevators, and even restrooms. Can you believe they name restrooms? They name these in a sworn public document.
Now, how far away can something be read, mm-hmm, or information be scanned?
Well, it varies quite a bit, and it can be a very short distance. It can be 20 or 30 feet. The government is looking to develop super capabilities. We found an RFI, a request for information, by the Department of Homeland Security They want to be able to scan people from up to 25 feet away. They want to pinpoint them on the street through documents containing these chips, whether they're rolled up in their pockets or in their wallets or backpacks. They want to be able to read these tokens, up to 55 of them, on buses as they roll in from other countries.
55 at a time.
55 tokens uniquely, yes. And they want to be able to track these RFID tags in cars speeding by at up to 55 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm. Sort of like the way they now monitor speed traps. But what about satellites and ships? Is there any technology involving satellites?
Yes, it's very possible if you have an active RFID tag. That would be one with batteries on board. You could actually communicate with low-orbiting satellites. In fact, scientists are tagging fish in the ocean, whales and turtles, and they actually, when they come to the surface, they can connect with a satellite. And, of course, when you have RFID tags, they uniquely identify objects. They can connect to other devices and hook to satellites. So you have this passive RFID tag, no battery. Seems innocuous, right? Read it from 20 feet away. Well, a reader device that reads that, you know, that's hidden someplace, could be connected to a GPS transceiver, right?
Okay, explain. Say we do see a reader, God forbid, in a public bathroom in New York.
I don't think you'll see it. I think they'll hide it.
Oh, right.
In fact, they're already putting them in soap dispensers. There's a company that has developed one.
You're saying that they could be hooked up to another device.
Absolutely. Why wouldn't they?
And explain to our listeners, give us a hypothetical of what this might mean. Where could it be used and for what nefarious purposes?
What it means is that an RFID tagged items, regardless of the distance at which it can be read, could communicate through other devices up to a satellite. You could pinpoint pretty much a tagged object anywhere on the planet if you have a reader device in range.
Oh, I see. So it extends the area that information can be communicated.
Absolutely.
Now, since we are a law-related program as well as political, I'm curious whether there have been any lawsuits yet brought around the chips.
I don't think it's been deployed widely enough yet for that to happen. But we're waiting. We're waiting.
Because this seems a field ripe for new legal interpretation, sort of like internet law.
Absolutely. I mean, you see these kinds of abuses, like these credit cards that can be scanned from a distance and you know, a potential of identity theft in these credit card companies not taking responsibility and recalling the cards or informing their customers. You see things like the Verichip going into people's bodies and people not knowing that, you know, because the Verichip Corporation has said, oh, if you don't want it, it's like a splinter. You just remove it. Well, a CNN reporter got shipped for a story she was doing, decided to have it removed, and she found out it was quite a medical procedure, had to have it surgically removed, and now has a scar. So, mm-hmm. You know, things like this that happen, people who get shipped who don't know, and by the way, those people at City Watcher, I called them before anyone else got to them, and I said, do you know this? Do you know that? No, they had no idea. No idea of the cloning, no idea about how hard it would be to remove this chip. Now, if those employees at some point decide, you know, this is simply not a good idea, which it simply isn't, they get smart to what this is really all about. And they say, you know, I'm no longer working here. I want this chip removed. And they realize, you know, they're going to have a permanent disfigurement and an ordeal. I can imagine that there are going to be some lawyers knocking on that company's door.
It definitely seems that this cuts across a range of areas, from privacy to liability for the corporations like the banks that start using this if identity theft becomes pervasive. It's horrifying, though, to think that one could be chipped and then have to have it surgically removed. And is there even a guarantee that a doctor can find it if they're so small?
Well, they are. Well, what the Verichip Corporation does is try to ensure this won't migrate, because obviously these chips could migrate to your pancreas or your brain, for example. In animal chips, they found that happening. So they found a little technique to help keep them in place. They put a sticky white substance called BioBond on the end of the chips, and it encourages scar tissue formation. So the scar tissue will hold it in place. So actually, when you want to remove it, then you have to cut away that scar tissue. Right. So, but still, even though that scar tissue will form, it is possible for it to migrate somewhat. And that example of the CNN reporter I talked about, that had migrated somewhat, just a little bit. But even a little bit on a small chip like that, you're talking about having to dig around inside somebody to locate it.
Liz, I looked at your fabulous website earlier today, spychips.com. Can you tell our listeners some of the things that we can be doing if we're concerned about the spread of chips?
Absolutely. Well, one is, of course, to educate yourself about what RFID technology is, and thank you for spreading the word about this to consumers who, I mean, how else will they find out? Of course, they can read our book, and hopefully now that they've heard this, they'll want to learn a lot more. We have a book by the same title, Spy Chips, out now. It's now a Penguin Plume book, and it's been updated since the hardcover came out. So we have some new information in there. And we ask that people tell their friends, their neighbors, their family, their churches, the places, you know, where they congregate, tell people there, because this has to be a grassroots effort. Unfortunately, a lot of commercial media outlets are beholden to big companies.
Big business. Well, would you advise members of the general public to write to big business and start campaigns telling them they don't want to buy their products?
Absolutely. And one thing people can do is vote with their dollars. The free marketplace is a great place to start. Companies exist because of us consumers and our shopping dollars. If we stop sending our shopping dollars their way, they're going to have to change or they're going to have to go out of business. And so we're telling people, you know, Walmart is the 800-pound gorilla of RFID and retail. They're forcing all of their suppliers to adopt the technology, even though they really don't want to. And they have to or they'll go out of business. Well, if we stop shopping at Walmart, we write to them and say why, or we cut back on our shopping. I know some people don't have a lot of choices, they're going to have to start listening. Procter & Gamble is a big proponent of RFID technology. They have patents out there for tracking people in stores. They're talking about tracking people through in their homes through their refrigerators. We say don't buy Procter & Gamble products.
Well, also, I'm wondering about pharmaceuticals. Will those be chipped? So would it be possible to find out what drugs someone is taking?
They're already being chipped.
Which is a huge invasion of
yeah,
privacy.
Yeah, Viagra, for example. I mean, you don't want to go out to dinner on a dinner date and have your have your date scan you from across the table and go, ew, Viagra. Yeah.
Liz, there are pills with chips in them?
Right. Actually, there's one product called Jonah, sort of named after the biblical story of Jonah and the whale. You swallow this RFID-laden pill, and it actually can monitor your temperature as it goes through your system. And it does actually come out at some point.
And is the purpose allegedly to assist in diagnosis?
Absolutely, at this point. But of course, if you can do it for that purpose, you can do it for another. And I've actually seen some other interesting patent applications on file about how to put these kinds of tags into things people would ingest and keep them there a little bit longer. And of course, you know,
so they remain in the body.
For some time, yeah. So yeah, and of course, with the developments in technology and nanotechnology, I expect we'll see much more invasive types of ingestible RFID products down the road.
Liz, just an estimate, how many patents are out there for RFID-related?
Oh, I have spent thousands and thousands of hours at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and I've just touched the surface. People are very excited about the possibilities with this, and of course, as with many kinds of areas of patenting, they're looking for, you know, any kind of opportunity. And if you can think of a bad idea, an invasive idea, I can tell you it's already
thought of. There are patents out there.
There are patents for it.
This is frightening. Would you say there are 100 patents out there?
100? Oh, my gosh. I would say thousands and thousands and thousands. And every day there are more.
Yeah,
top five bad patent applications.
So we can make a list.
Oh, my gosh. Well, IBM tops my list. IBM, with its identification and tracking of persons using RFID-tagged items, their bad idea of tracking people through things they wear and carry that are associated with them at point of purchase. And then, on top of that, that's bad enough, you know, using it for marketing purposes. But on top of that, they talk about the government tracking people with that. That's got to be number one for me.
Right.
Number two, oh my gosh, there are so many. NCR has a patent application for tracking people in store environments, and they have it down to where people could pick up things off of store shelves, and the reader systems could know. They're picking up a can, for example.
A can of beans.
A can of beans. They can time how long the person holds
the can. Looks at it.
Whether they put it back on the shelf and pick something else up, infer whether the person is you know, comparison shopping, looking at whether they put it in their cart and take it back out again, what other things are in there. It's all about getting more money from consumers and knowing all about them, things that even their mothers don't have a right to know.
But then clearly the repercussions are that we could have someone spying on us in our own homes for hours at a time.
Yeah, I think we have another one that's right up there on my list, Accenture. It's a spinoff, I believe, of Ernst & Young. Remember when accounting firms had to split their consulting businesses away?
Right.
You know, for ethical reasons.
Right.
Well, I guess, you know, Accenture decided that it would be a great fun to develop all kinds of RFID ideas. One of their really bad ideas is their patented idea they call the Real World Showroom. And this whole idea is that the whole world will be a showroom, and people with armed with PDAs could just click away on people walking down the street to figure out what they're wearing and carrying, how much it costs, and how they can get one themselves.
No.
We think that that's a really, really bad idea, and we've nicknamed this the pervert's best friend.
So that's
number three on my
right.
list of the top
right.
five.
Number four. What's number four?
Number four. Bank of America has a patent here. It's called System and Method for Interactive Advertising. And what they propose is having these sort of kiosk-type things or posters out in public places like train stations and so on. And these posters would have RFID reader devices in them. So when people congregate, they could know the exact identity of someone by a key fob or something about the people who are congregating. And then they could actually deliver specific advertising, actually talk to these people. They're talking about having speaker systems in there. And they're talking about having ways that they can actually watch people, too, at the same time and watch their reactions.
Gauge their reactions.
Absolutely. Now, what's really funny about this patent application, the speaker system, they talk about how this they've actually considered privacy in developing this particular device.
How so?
They say that the audio device is designed only to project to persons who are directly in front of the display. And they claim that this will allow the customer to, quote, have some degree of privacy, at least with regard to the audio program of an interactive poster.
Does the patent office look at the legality and the privacy concerns?
I don't believe that's the job of the patent and trademark office. I think they're just supposed to look at ideas, and they're supposed to say, is this a unique idea? Is it workable? Because, you know, when you file a patent application, you have to swear it works. And this is a serious document. You're under oath when you
send. So have these been tested?
Well, they have to send in schematics about how it would work. And, of course, the people examining these patent applications, and they have to have a background in the technology. And so, yes, I would have to say that they work. And by the way, if anyone out there in the listening audience believes that, or any companies out there that have filed these patents and they say, really, we were only joking, these really don't work, well, there's a penalty for that.
Mm.
And we would love to know about it and talk about litigation.
Well, I think a lot of us would like to talk about litigation, Liz, and this has added just more information to the chilling documents that you've provided us in your wonderful book, Spy Chips, which is now available from Penguin Books.
Yes, it's a Penguin book under the Plume imprint, and it's available in all the major bookstores, and of course, you can order it online, too.
Liz, what would be number five on your list?
Well, you know, ordering these is really hard because they're all so bad. But these last two, we're hoping will never really be implemented. So I'm making these five. There are two I'm going to
try.
A tie. And these all have to do with actually RFID and human beings. And yeah, one is called Method and Apparatus for Locating and Tracking Persons. Now, this is a patent application by a company in California called Persephone, and they're talking about the verichip not being buried deeply enough in the human body because it could be removed. So they're talking about burying these tracking chips deep within the human body, and in the patent application, they show internal organs of females and males, places like the uterus where there are natural pockets and these things could go in permanently and not be removed. They talk about adding some features to this device, including a cattle prod device that could electroshock you from inside. They talk about adding microphones that could project your conversations remotely, and a GPS tracking device that could actually be used to locate someone who might be lost or purposely lost.
Liz, did I hear you? Cattle prodding device?
Correct. It's an electroshock feature. They suggest adding to this particular.
I could see product. Law enforcement coming up with applications for this.
Absolutely. And now you want to hear the other one? I mean, it's also terrible. I have to warn you. We call it the human enslavement device, and it's actually a bulletproof armband that communicates by radio waves, and it has an injector device. So if you step out of line, someone could remotely trigger the injection device to deliver a knockout drug to you. This is called Method and Apparatus for Remote Monitoring and Control of a Target Group. The person who patented this, now this is not a big company that patented this.
I'd like
this
to
thing.
Hear who patented this.
I don't know if I should say it on the air. It's actually...
Well, he's in the book, isn't
he?
Right,
you're right. He's in the book, and he actually is on file at the Patent and Trademark Office. It's a public document. We're allowed to say it, I guess. George Vodin. And he comes
I'd
up
love
with
to know George's background.
I expect that some journalist is probably going to call this guy up. We've been waiting. We've been wondering, why hasn't anyone called him up and say, what were you thinking? But anyway, this device would deliver a knockout drug, and we figure...
Well, I think these should be number one on our list, quite
honestly.
But,
I think they're probably less likely. The others are actually, they're...
Realistic possibilities.
And not to say these aren't realistic. I mean, they could absolutely happen, especially... But we figure that slaveholders, third world dictators, sadistic school administrators, terrorist kidnappers, and dungeon prison guards overseeing hellholes everywhere would love to get their hands on these kinds of gadgets.
Liz, this is if it weren't so horrific, it would be humorous.
Well, sometimes you have to laugh to keep from crying.
Right.
But yeah, this is very serious technology. It's coming our way. People have got to know what's happening. They've got to tell other people, and they've got to be prepared.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
As real as it seems, the American dream ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shot up and back in chains. Who denies of the future, rob our name, kept my history a mystery, but now I see the American dream wasn't meant for me, cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me, promised for freedom, education, equality, never gave me nothing but slavery, and now look at how dangerous you made me, calling me a madman, cause I'm strong and bold, with this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told, promised me emancipation, and this new nation, all you ever gave my people was salvation, fathers of this country never cared for me, they kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery, and Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me, except lie about the facts in my history, so now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed, but the government's glad cause they enjoy when my people are down, so they can screw us around, time to change the government now, Panther power, Panther power. American dream was an American nightmare. You kept my people down and refused to fight fair. Took the Ku Klux Klan, tried to keep us out. We signed truth and state no blacks allowed. With intimidation and segregation was the way for our freedom, but now we're impatient. Blacks, the other of skin, yeah, don't sell out. Freedom, equality, get out, yell out. Don't you never be ashamed of what you are. It's your Panther power that makes you a star. Panther power. Panther power. My mother never let me forget my history, hoping I was set free. Chains I would put on me, wanted to be more than just free. Had to know the true facts about my history. I couldn't settle for being a statistic. Couldn't survive in this capitalistic government, cause it was meant to hold us back. Using ignorance, drugs, the sneak attack in my community. They killed the unity, but when I charge them, try to claim immunity. I strike America like a case of heart disease. Panther power is running through my arteries. Try to stop me, oh boy, you'll be clawed to death. Cause I'll be fighting for my freedom with my dying breath. Do you remember? That's what I'm asking you. You think you're living free? Don't make me laugh at you. Open your eyes, realize you've been locked in chains. Said you wasn't civilized and stole your name. Cause some time has passed, seem to all forget. There is no liberty for you and me, we ain't free yet. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power.